If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
They were campaigning for their human rights. And I think if you look at it as a human rights movement, you get quite a different perspective.
That was June Purvis discussing the suffrage campaigners of 100 years ago.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. This is our second episode of the week, devoted to the story of the Battle for Votes for Women, on the centenary of some British women being granted the vote in 1918. Today's interview is with June Purvis, Emeritus Professor of Women's and Gender History at the University of Portsmouth, and author of a new biography of Christabel Pankhurst. June spoke to our Deputy Editor, Charlotte Hodgman, about the long and sometimes controversial campaign for female suffrage.
Your biography of Christabel Pankhurst has just come out. What made you want to focus on Christabel of all the Pankhurst sisters?
Well, I knew Jill Craigie when she was alive. She was the wife of Michael Foot, one-time Labour Party leader. And I thought Christabel had been very misrepresented, and I got in touch with Jill, and she thought the same. And there is this biography of her, the only one that there is, written by David Mitchell and published in 1977. And it is so anti-feminist. He presents her as having incestuous desires on her mother, as being autocratic, ruthless, you name it, every bad adjective you could use against a feminist is there. And somehow I didn't feel this was right. And I began reading about Christabel and some of her writing. So that prompted me really to go into the research, into the archives a lot more.
What's your impression of what she was like as a woman?
Well, I think she was very determined. She was uncompromising in her attitude on the votes for women question, but she was also kind. And I think that is something that doesn't come out at all in the David Mitchell biography, nor in the very influential book written by her sister Sylvia, The Suffragette Movement, 1931, that was first published. And Sylvia's The Suffragette Movement has become the standard reading of the suffragette movement and of Pankhurst family life. And in that book, Sylvia represents Christabel as being, once again, ruthless, but also right-wing. And I don't think she was right-wing. What we've got to remember is that Sylvia was a socialist feminist, and she wrote her book, The Suffragette Movement, from that angle. So she wants to portray the class conflict between working class and middle class women, And she wants to ally the Women's Social and Political Union, or WSPU, she wants to ally that to the socialist movement. Now, Christabel, I think you can only understand her if you see her as a radical feminist who wanted to unite all women together, irrespective of their social class, and whose main concern was the power struggle between women and men. And so Christabel saw the liberal government and men generally as being very anti-female liberation.
Okay. I mean, it sounds like there's quite a big divide then between Sylvia and Christabel in their beliefs. What about the other siblings and also their mother? I mean, what were relationships like between them all? They all had quite different personalities and beliefs, didn't they?
Yes, I think the upbringing of the Pankhurst girls in particular explains a lot about their later life. So they were taken to radical meetings at an early age. They had literature about radical issues, about women's suffrage, delivered to their home, and they read all that, and they were often involved in collecting money at these meetings and talking to the people and hearing the discussions that were going on. And so this made them all quite individualistic. And Emmeline Pankhurst said that she didn't want her children to go to school because she thought they would lose their individuality. And what you find is that there was a particular rivalry that developed between Christabel and Sylvia as they grew older. When they were younger, Christabel was very much the older sister who looked after Sylvia, who had poor eyesight and didn't learn to read until she was about six or so. But as they got older, the rivalry between Christabel and Sylvia develops quite strongly. And that was because Christabel became very critical of socialist men in the Independent Labour Party who wouldn't give priority to women's suffrage, whereas Sylvia was much more a socialist in that way and accepted what the ILP was saying.
Okay. I mean, you've previously described Christabel as being her mother's favourite. Is that something you still stand by?
Yes, Christabel was her mother's favourite child. She was the only child that Emmeline breastfed. And all the children knew that and they accepted it. But she was also very bright. And being the eldest, you know, treated much more like an adult.
I mean, her first sort of real, she sort of came to public notice was during a Liberal Party meeting when she sort of interrupted by shouting demands for voting rights for women. What impact did this have sort of on her and also on the cause itself?
The Free Trade Hall meeting on the 13th of October 1903, when Christabel and Annie Kenney asked a question about votes for women from the Liberal MP, Sir Edward Grey. That was very important because they waited till the end of his speech, asked their questions. He didn't reply. Then they were told to put the question in writing, which they did, and he still didn't comment. And so then they jumped up and shouted out, will a Liberal government give votes to women? That was very, very important because they were rushed outside where they were arrested because Christabel committed the technical offence of spitting at a policeman. And so they were arrested, and in the police court next day, they refused to pay a fine, but chose imprisonment instead. Christabel had a week, Annie had 5 days in prison. And of course, that was taken up by the press and splashed on the front pages. And it brought a lot of women into the WSPU. Don't forget, it was women only. And that, I think that shows how brilliant Christabel was as a tactician. She was the key strategist of the WSPU, and she devised all sorts of tactics like this to make the Votes for Women campaign a national campaign.
I mean, what was prison like for her at this time in history? What would she have experienced when she was in prison?
They were put in a strange ways prison in Manchester, and she found it quite claustrophobic, as did Annie. Annie in particular found it very difficult, and when they went to chapel, Christabel made sure that she held Annie's hand because Annie was finding it very difficult. And Christabel also writes about the wooden spoon that prisoners had to eat their horrible sort of food with, and how it couldn't be cleaned properly, and how there wasn't a hot water to wash the dishes that they used for their food.
I mean, prison, a number of the sisters, well, Sylvia and Crispo were sort of went to prison a number of times, didn't they? Sylvia went on hunger strike. I don't know whether Christabel, did she?
No, she didn't. And I think because she was the key strategist and tactician of the WSPU, they wanted to keep her out of prison. So that was an agreement with her and her mother and with Emmeline Peckett Lawrence, who was the other leader of the WSPU.
Okay. I mean, Sylvia had to experience force feeding, didn't she? Can you maybe just explain a little bit about the sort of government thinking behind this? What were they hoping to achieve by doing this to the suffragettes?
Yes, well, it was in July 1909 that Marion Wallace Dunlop went on hunger strike, and she was released after 71 hours. And the WSPU and Christabel and Emmeline Pankhurst, they all thought, oh, this is wonderful. We've got a tactic with which to beat the government. But of course, by the end of September 1909, the government was forcibly feeding hunger striking women. And they justified that in terms of saving them from dying. You know, these were women who would starve themselves to death. And they also said it was a common practice on lunatics. That was the word they used at the time. And those who were mentally impaired in other ways.
And it would have been a horrific experience for them.
Being forcibly fed was a horrific experience. And if you read the accounts of the women who were forcibly fed, it brought tears to my eyes. There were two main methods of forcible feeding. You could either have a tube about 3 to 4 feet long stuck up your nose, up your nostril, or the worst method was to hold open your jaws with clamps, either wooden clamps or steel clamps, that cut into the soft tissue of the mouth and then push this tube down. And the liquid that they used often was a greasy sort of mixture of animal fats. And then the tube would be pulled out roughly, and usually you would vomit all over the people who had forcibly fed you. And if you read the accounts by the suffragettes who were forcibly fed, you find many of them saw it as a form of instrumental rape of the body, you know, this pushing of tubes into you. And of course, there was overwhelming physical force used, just as in rape. You were held down either on a bed by four sturdy wardresses, or your ankles were tied to a chair and you were pulled back. So it was a horrendous experience. And some people, don't forget, were forcibly fed at least 252 times. That happened to Kitty Marion and Grace Rowe.
How did the public feel once this information got out? Did it create more sympathy for the suffragettes?
I think the population, as far as you can gauge it, I think they were mixed in their views. I think there was initial horror about it. And then by about beginning of 1914, when suffragettes were being drugged as well to make them more docile in order to make it easier to push these tubes into their bodies, by then, by early 1914, I think there was very much a revulsion against it. And also some doctors spoke out very bravely against it, saying it was being used as a punishment for the women and not as, medical practice to save lives.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
One of the enduring debates about the suffragettes is their use of violence and whether it was justified in getting the vote. How did Christabel feel about the sort of militant side of the cause and the use of violence to win the vote for women?
Well, I think it's a much misunderstood term, militancy, as she developed it and as the suffragettes spoke about it. It included a wide range of behaviours. So for Christabel, militancy meant throwing off the slave spirit that she thought women had developed, whereby they were always subservient to men. So for her, it meant women being articulate, demanding, not asking politely, for their political rights. And it involved a wide range of activities. So it could involve setting fire to a post box, destroying the mail. But it could also involve other more peaceful things, like standing up in a church service and a Church of England service and interrupting when they said the creed and say, "We pray for Emmeline Pankhurst and Christabel, her daughter, dee-dum-dee-dum-dee-dee." And if you read that, it's really quite wonderful, that feminist version of the creed, because it's got the same rhythm as the Church of England creed. That was also a militant act. Whether militancy helped or hindered the campaign is a debate amongst historians. Now, why did the suffragettes become more militant from 1912 and engage in damage to property? Well, one of the key reasons was the violence they experienced on Black Friday on the 18th of November 1910, when they tried to reach Parliament with a petition about votes for women, and they were roughly pushed back by the police. Now, many of the assaults that they experienced at that time were sexual in nature. So breasts were pinched, policemen's legs were put between the crotches of women. They were pulled by their hair. They had their skirts pulled up over their head. And the women said to Mrs. Pankhurst, "What is the point of us campaigning peacefully for the vote for women if we're going to be treated in this way. We might as well take a stone and break a window, and then the policeman would come running to arrest us, and then we'd go to prison that way without less damage to our bodies. So I think that explains the step change and going to these more militant methods from 1912. Now, whether the more militant methods from 1912 helped or hindered the campaign, I think you've got to relate this very much to the gender of the people doing this. These were women, some of them middle-class women, some of them in professions, some of them working-class women doing this. And there was a general feeling of revulsion. Women acting like this, they're supposed to be feminine and home-loving. So I think you've got to look at it through these gendered eyes. Christabel's argument was that men had used violence to get the vote and they were successful. Why shouldn't women do it? And if you look carefully at the kind of acts of damage to property they did, they always made sure that they never killed anybody and they never harmed anyone. You know, sometimes stones would be wrapped in paper when thrown through a window. So, I just can't understand why people don't think it helped the cause at all. I think it did, because it showed that women were not prepared to be doormats any longer. And whether they were terrorists, I think this is a very futile debate. Some people argue that they were terrorists. I mean, it's like saying that people in South Africa campaigning against apartheid were terrorists. They were claiming for a democratic right to be recognized as human beings just because they were black. They wanted to be recognized as human beings. And similarly with the suffragettes. And this is a very important point, that they were campaigning for their human rights. And I think if you look at it as a human rights movement, you get quite a different perspective.
What about the First World War? Because suffragette activity died down a lot, didn't it, during the First World War? Do you think that the vote would have happened or been given if the First World War hadn't have happened? Was it kind of inevitable?
No, I think the campaign before the First World War was critical in getting women the vote. And don't forget, although Christabel and Emmeline Pankhurst called off the damage to property militancy, they didn't, and this is a very important point, they didn't drop the campaign for women's suffrage. What they did was they became very patriotic. They spoke about the necessity for women to engage in war work as a way to win their enfranchisement after the war. So it's still there in their speeches about votes for women, but it's not just a single issue campaign, of course. And this debate about the war won women the vote, well, if you look at the categories of women who were enfranchised with the 1918 Act, they were certain categories of women over the age of 30 and women graduates. And the Act did not enfranchise the young working-class woman without a property qualification who had worked in the munitions factory. So they were excluded.
Do you think the Pankhursts are overrated in, you know, having achieved the vote for women?
No, I mean, everybody played their part who campaigned for the vote, and that's very important to say that. But I think the point about the Pankhursts, and particularly Emmeline and Christabel, is that they were inspirational, charismatic figures who were also powerful orators. And they had this cry of rise up women. And women did rise up. Thousands and thousands of women joined the suffrage movement. And, of course, many more read their newspapers, first of all, Votes for Women, and then from October 1912, the Suffragette. So it was spread around. And women would sometimes just give money to the suffragette cause, but they wouldn't engage in the militant acts. So they were almost like silent activists, I call them. They were subscribers, but they were important because they still gave money. And even from 1912, you find that the income for the WSPU was very high.
Christabel was one of 17 women who stood for election in 1918, the year that the vote was given to certain women over the age of 30. Did she expect to win her seat?
No. I've gone through all the documentation that I had on that, and she thought she wouldn't win, that there was too much prejudice against women being in Parliament. And she lost, as you know, by just over 700 votes. And from what I can gather from the sources, her mother was more disappointed for her eldest daughter failing to get into Parliament than Christabel herself.
Mm. I mean, did Emmeline not want to stand herself for Parliament?
No, she thought she wanted that honour for her daughter, her eldest daughter and her favourite daughter. And I think she thought she was too old. Really, too.
What was sort of the level of support for Christabel among female voters? Do we know whether she got a lot of the female votes, or were even women a bit wary of having a woman in Parliament?
She stood in a working class constituency, Smethwick, in the Midlands, and she campaigned hard there for her own election, and she had a group of supporters. And I think the female munition workers did support her. She was quite popular with them, and she only lost by a small amount. And some historians think that if she had stood in a more middle-class constituency, she would have been elected.
What happened to the Pankhursts once the Representation of the People Act had been passed in 1918, in February? What did the Pankhursts do after that? Did they continue campaigning for those women who were still disenfranchised, or did they go off and do different things?
Well, don't forget, Emmeline didn't have any money, and so she had to find work, and she couldn't find work in Britain, but the Canadian government offered her a job lecturing about the dangers of venereal disease, and so she goes off to Canada. Christabel later joins her there. The war had a profound effect upon Christabel, particularly all the carnage, you know, with so many young men being killed. She was browsing in a bookshop one day and she comes across a book on the Second Coming of Christ. And by November 1918, she is converted to Second Adventism. But she keeps it quiet for at least 3 years, and it's not until 1921... that she comes out as a Second Adventist. That is someone who believes in the imminent coming of Jesus Christ. And she then has this second career as a very successful writer of Second Adventist books, and also as a very successful preacher of the Second Advent. What is interesting about this phase in her life, that she often emphasizes the role of women in Christianity. So, for example, that when Christ was crucified and his body was placed in the tomb, it was women whom he first spoke to. So you find still a feminist thread going through her writings. And also, don't forget that women weren't accepted in the Church of England at that time as priests. And so she went to the Second Advent testimony, which did accept women. So it was still a feminist act. There were still few women preachers at that time. And she was very successful in that. And, of course, she was living in the United States then, which I think is much more, where Christianity is much more acceptable. So from 1940, she lived in the United States until she died in 1958. Sylvia, on the other hand, after 1918, became more left-wing. She became a founder, one of the founders of the British Communist Party, and she came to believe in extra-parliamentary activity. And then in 1927, she gave birth to a son while she was unmarried, And of course, as you probably know, that deeply upset her mother because she thought it was such a disgrace to the Pankhurst name. Because Sylvia went to the News of the World and told her story about being a single mother and how her mother had neglected her and wouldn't answer her letters when she wrote to her about the birth of her son. And what had happened, in fact, is that Christabel and some other friends had deliberately not shown these letters to Emmeline because she was already quite worn out after all her imprisonment. And so she didn't know about this child. And the first time she found out about it was when she read the Sunday newspapers. And Emmeline, by then, was standing as a Conservative candidate. And she just went downhill from that. And you find a lot of the aged suffragettes blamed Sylvia for the early death of her mother.
It's very sad, isn't it?
It is.
Quite a fractured family in the end.
Yes, it was. And, I've written quite a bit about their childhood. And I do think the fact that they were treated as individuals and treated like little adults almost, particularly the two eldest girls, Christabel and Sylvia, and this emphasis upon individuality was so important for them. I wonder if that explains why they had such different paths in life. We haven't spoken about the youngest girl, Adela. She was committed to socialism like Sylvia, and she couldn't make up her mind what she wanted to do from 1912. First of all, she wanted to be a writer, and her mother, Emmeline, was very worried about that because she thought she can't support herself for the rest of her life just by writing. Then she wanted to be a teacher. Then she goes off to be a governess with Helen Archdale, who is very kind to her, looks after her. And then by 1914, Emmeline has got it into her head that somehow Adela is going to set up a rival organisation to Christabel's. And so she arranges for this youngest daughter to go out to Australia. And that is what happens. So Adela goes to Australia, strongly socialist, marries a trade unionist and very much into the socialist movement. But then, towards the end of her life, she contacts her mother and says, I agree with you, and turns right-wing and converts to Roman Catholicism. So, they really do have a divergence of ways, these women.
And in the meantime, back in England, did the suffragette movement continue? Were people still campaigning for more women to get the vote?
Yes. Let me just go back to where were we, 1918. Yes, 1918, because Emmeline goes off to Canada because she's got to earn a living, often the campaign for the vote was left to other groups, the six-point group, etc., and some of the suffragists. And so they did campaign then to keep pressure up, I should say, on the government to introduce equality for women on the same terms as men for parliamentary voting. And it was a Conservative government under Baldwin who actually brought in equality for women, voting at the same age as men, that is the age of 21. The Ramsay-MacDonald government, the Labour government of the early 1920s, didn't do that, despite saying that they might. And I think that is something that the Labour Party ought to consider. They didn't do that. And that was something that Emmeline and Christabel were very conscious of.
And, of course, Emmeline never lived to see, did she, the vote being given to all women?
No, I think that's, one of the tragedies of history. She knew it was coming, but she died, as you know, a few weeks before it finally came.
That was June Purvis. Christabel Pankhurst, A Biography, is out now, published by Routledge. And June is one of the contributors to our February edition, which is a women's suffrage special. Look out for it now in all good retailers and in our digital formats. Well, that's about it for today, but please do rejoin us on Monday when we'll be looking at a very different aspect of the year 1918, the Spanish flu outbreak.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.